Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. If you like this podcast, you should check out the full finance journey at realvision.com/RVpod to get the full view of what Real Vision is all about. A video on demand platform you can watch anywhere. Our members get daily videos and analysis, plus access to more than 3,000 videos for beginners and experienced investors alike, and live events online. You'll join the most thoughtful community in finance. More than 300,000 people who trust Real Vision to be the anchor to truth in the financial world. To get started, visit realvision.com/RVpod. Use the promo code PODCAST10 to get 10% off our essential membership for your first year. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, June 8, 2022. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. Let's take a look at the closing prices on U.S. equities here as we have this conversation around 4 o'clock, closing out the day. It's a down one. S&P 500 off about 45 points, 1%, 1.08%, 4,115 on the close. NASDAQ also down on the day, off about 0.75%, closing the day out at 12,086. Dow Jones Industrial Average following suit, down 0.8%, closing out the day here at 32,910. European equity markets closed fractionally lower on the day ahead of tomorrow's ECB rate decision. Talking of international markets, before we jump in with Darius, we're going to pause for an update on global markets by Real Vision's own Weston Nakamura, who joins us live from Tokyo. Weston, welcome back.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you? How are we?
We're doing great, man. Not like dollar yen. Let's talk about it. It's ugly.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're long the dollar side, it's not so ugly. It's quite doing well. But we've broken into the 134 handle on dollar yen. So now the yen is just continuing to get crushed.
Folks who don't follow this currency pair, give us a sense of what 134 means and why it's so significant.
Yeah, so I mean, 133.80 was the resistance that was broken that then, you know, continued into the 134 handle. 133.80 was, a previous high. Right now, we're looking at the next level being 135.18. This is 2002 high. That's just a few ticks away. Yeah. If that's broken, we're at a new millennium high, right. 1998, I believe. So we're at the weakest levels. And not just the level itself, but like Darius and I have talked about on the briefing before. It's not so much the level, it's the pace in which it gets to this level. It's the volatility, the velocity of the move in and of itself,
right.
That is of concern.
Yeah, if you're looking at that chart, you can see the just extreme steepness on that curve. By the way, for people who are relatively new to currency markets, we should say dollar yen, this shows dollar strength, Japanese yen weakness. So when you see that chart moving up and to the right dramatically, it's the dollar strengthening, the yen plunging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is chart one. If you're looking at that right now, but what I always go to is looking at dollar yen spot and the U.S. 10-year yield. They move in tandem, and so that's why you should care about what dollar yen is doing, because it moves along with the risk-free rate. And I don't care what you invest in; you need to know what the risk-free rate is doing. However, as of late with this breakout, you're starting to see dollar yen really, push through to these, these at least certainly year-to-day highs, whereas the 10-year yield is not. So there is a bit of a
difference. Talk to us about the directionality of that correlation, because it's an extraordinary chart when you show 10-year yield against dollar yen.
Sure. If you look at chart two, okay, what that is these are weekly flow data from the Ministry of Finance in Japan that shows basically foreign bond, net foreign bond buying or selling by Japanese investors. And as you can see throughout the bulk of this, you know, March, you know, surge in treasury yields, that coincided with a massive, massive unloading of foreign bonds. This is not just U.S. treasuries, but a lot of it is from Japan. Then you see these 2 weeks in which you actually see some, you know, a bit of a sort of meaningful inflow of net buying. That was when treasury yields came down recently. And then last week, we saw continued selling again. This is 1 week delayed data, but you can really see that there is a material impact from these flows that are coming from Japan, particularly Japan lifers, life insurance companies, who are these, you know, these massive capital allocators. They, a lot of them recently came out with their investment, you know, fiscal year 22 investment, you know, planning, if you will. And it's interesting just to see, I mean, these are always subject to change, not that they're not always followed, but the ranges for, like, you know, what they're trying to do and all that is, like, so their upper range, the highest estimate or highest outlook for dollar yen by year end is 140 for these lifers. 10-year JGB is 25 basis points where the cap is. One of them was actually above that. So one of them believes that it's not going to hold that. And then the highest for the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield was forecast was somewhere around 3.4%. So 3.4% with a 25 basis point JGB pinned, 140 dollar yen is basically what that means. So 140 is really not that, like, doomsday out of the question. They're in the model forecasts for these major you know, allocators.
Weston, we really appreciate you joining us from the middle of the night from Tokyo. Just to double click on it one more time, the significance of this to global markets.
Yeah, chart three is basically just the first two of the first two charts just combined. And you can just clearly see, I'm going to put this up on Twitter as well, but you need to, you really need to watch dollar yen, because you really need to watch what, you know, to get some sort of price signal as to what Japanese investors are or are not doing. It gets more complicated with, like, you know, currency hedge and all that kind of thing. But by and large, just you need to keep an eye on this. And also because, simply because, you know, U.S. Treasuries, this is the risk-free rate we're talking about. And right. So if you have something that is as closely correlated to the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, dollar yen, then you certainly need to look at that, you know, that asset class as well.
Yeah. And by the way, for people who are interested in more, they can follow you at Across the Spread on Twitter, where they'll see many more of these charts and more of this analysis.
Indeed.
Weston Nakamura, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Darius, for letting me interrupt you once again.
No, I love it, my friend. I love it. And Ash, one quick thing before we transition. I did want to make the key point and why investors should care about these dollar yen, these cross-currency dynamics, is because the policy divergence between the Bank of Japan maintaining its yield curve control with effectively unlimited buying of JGBs on the long end of the curve creates this sort of massive spread between you know, market implied interest rates in Japan relative to our interest rates in the treasury curve. And so as long as the BOJ is deemed to be sort of maintaining that easy policy, it's an incentive for Japanese investors to go out and speculate abroad, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem with speculating in the treasury market, as we continue to see, is this market continues to underestimate the Fed's resolve with respect to tightening monetary policy and, more importantly, the stickiness of inflation. So those are two things I think we should touch on today.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Well, Darius Taylor, in many ways, that's the perfect transition from the dollar-yen story into the broader macro picture. Give us a little bit of context of what's on your radar and how you're thinking about these markets right now.
Yeah, so it's a pretty quiet week. I mean, obviously, we're in the quiet period from the perspective of FOMC speakers. We got the meeting next Wednesday. So the kind of the key headline this week, that's going to take the headline this week, is Friday's CPI report. Tomorrow, we'll get the ECB. I don't want to rain on their parade. And we'll also get the Chinese credit data for the month of May tomorrow night as well. We can touch on those. But I think very clearly the number one thing that's going to rock markets this week to the upside or downside is inflation. We'll get that print on Friday. I think consensus is expecting a tick down by the 10 basis points or so on headline, a tick down by 20 to 30 basis points on core. But to me, I don't think the year-over-year rate of change, and we've been talking about this for 9 months now, I don't think the year-over-year rate of change matters. What matters is the sequential momentum in inflation, because that will be the clearest indication for the Fed and for financial market participants of receiving what quote-unquote clear and confirming evidence that inflation is either getting back under control or continuing to misbehave. I'll throw a few statistics and charts out there at you. So to me, I think the biggest risk with respect to Friday's print is this potentiality that we get an overtaking of core inflation momentum by services inflation relative to goods inflation. So Brian, if you throw up a couple charts, the first chart just shows what if the title is what if disinflation in core goods CPI dot dot dot. And what we're showing there is just the core goods inflation in the top panel. The middle panel shows that on a year-over-year rate of change basis. The bottom panel shows that on a three-month annualized basis. And right now we're seeing a significant slowdown in the three-month annualized rate of core goods CPI. It's at about 0.8% on a three-month annualized basis. That's all the way down from the year-over-year rate of 9.7%. So that's what's really driving the disinflation we've seen in core inflation off the highs, the disinflation in core PCE we've seen off the highs. But the issue is, and the next chart is dot, 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 is overpowered by accelerating core services prices. And the reason I bring this up is because we continue to see evidence of an incremental acceleration in services prices. What this chart is showing, top panels is core services on a core services prices year over year in the middle panel and the three-month annualized in the bottom panel. And if you notice, the three-month annualized there not only is accelerating to 7.5-ish% on a three-month annualized basis, that's significantly faster than the year-over-year rate of 4.9%. So it's telling you we're continuing to build momentum to the upside in that time series. And oh, by the way, we still have things like energy prices climbing new highs, agricultural prices grinding higher. And so to me, I think the key takeaway before we pause is if we get inflation statistics misbehaving by this dynamic, we're going to see an incremental step function higher in bond yields and policy rate expectations, et cetera.
Darius, it's a striking chart. Walk us through it, particularly for people who don't have extensive macro backgrounds. What are we seeing there? What's the driver? What's the broader implications?
Absolutely. So the top panel is just showing the time series in a non-stationary manner. So core services inflation. So things like housing, rent, utilities, et cetera. It's basically, you know, all the stuff we consume from a service perspective, medical consumption. Most services generally tend to be core, fall in the core basket in that regard. So this is you know, the larger lion's share of inflation. I mean, it's basically 60 to 65% of the overall CPI basket. And so, you know, the fact that it's being overpowered by goods disinflation is anomalous, which tells you that if goods disinflation slows at any point in time in the next few months, what's more likely to happen is that this does in fact become the dominant driver of inflation as it traditionally is, and it'll likely keep inflation, particularly core inflation, operating at a more sticky kind of level for the summer months.
Yeah. The other thing that's striking to me about the lower two panels is what, you know, every serious macro person will tell you the same thing. It's not just absolute levels. Rate of change matters.
Rate of change, rate of change, rate of change, man. It's the secret to the universe. It's the secret to financial markets. And so, you know, most economic statistics, for those of us, you know, who aren't walking economists, they tend to get measured at least on a year-over-year rate of change basis. That tends to matter a lot to financial market participants and obviously market and policymakers as well. What I think has mattered most throughout this particular cycle, just given the sort of unusual nature of this pandemic recovery, we've seen some massive stimulus. We've seen the roll-off of massive stimulus. We've seen several fits and starts from a COVID perspective. And so what has put a lot of onus on tracking time series from a sequential momentum perspective, month over month, 3-month annualized, et cetera, to get a sort of cleaner read on the data because there's been so much lumpiness in the year-over-year time series. And so when you look at things like core services inflation at 7.5% three-month annualized, median CPI, which is the median inflation rate of everything in the CPI basket, at 6.2% annualized, or sticky CPI, which is one of the statistics down the Fed calculates. They're probably as close to the inflation measurement as any of the Federal Reserve banks. That 6.5% three-month annualized, these numbers are all extremely inconsistent with the Fed getting core PCE back to its 2% target anytime soon. And so to me, I think the risk in financial markets, particularly from, you know, anything north of 4,000 on the S&P or anything north than, you know, the 3.5 on maybe 1 year forward, you know, Eurodollar pricing, Fed fund futures pricing, et cetera, to me, is the risk is to the upside on rates and to the downside and risk asset market pricing.
Yeah. So let's walk through that a little bit, try and explain it a little bit, particularly for people who are not macro focused. I'm curious about this. There's this sort of old phrase out there, kind of a joke, kind of not a joke, that the cure for high prices is higher prices, meaning that as prices begin to rise, there's a natural decrease in demand that happens. You start to see some contractionary risk in terms of growth, in terms of productivity, in terms of a whole series of other variables. One of the stories on the wire today that's really interesting is that mortgage demand right now has fallen to 22-year lows, a pretty striking number. Again, to get back into the thesis, cure for high prices is higher prices, this idea that one of the things that you've been hearing everyone talking about the last 6 to 12 months is how rents have been increasing here in New York City. It's a constant topic. My landlord wants to increase my rent 15%, 20%, 25%. When I walk down the streets, there's a building on the corner that's been vacant for the 16 years that I've lived here. They're now renovating and rehabbing those apartments. Why? Because it's become economically advantageous to do so. It's such a seller's market right now. And then you see this print showing that there's a significant decline, a 22-year low, in fact, in the rate of mortgage consumption. What's happening there, Darius? Help us understand it.
Yeah, so the housing market, you're absolutely right. High prices is the cure for high prices. We've seen negative year-over-year mortgage demand for, you know, basically about 6 to 9 months now, and that's likely to continue. I mean, you look at the last two prints we've gotten from out of the housing market from a home price appreciation standpoint, whether you look at the CoreLogic Case-Shiller numbers accelerating to an all-time high north of 20% year over year, the FIFA, which tends to measure housing prices, you know, kind of in the middle to lower incomes cohort, that's also accelerating to an all-time high. That was Q1 data a couple weeks ago. And the issue with that as it relates to inflation, going back to this discussion between core goods and core services inflation, is, you know, something like shelter inflation is about a third of the basket. You know, an owner's equivalent rent, which is, you know, a function of shelter or one of the features of shelter inflation, that's about, you know, 75% of that particular, you know, component in the CPI basket. And so as long as we have home prices continue to accelerate, it's likely to have a tail in terms of perpetuating the acceleration we're observing in owner's equivalent rent and by extension, shelter inflation. I mean, we've done an analysis that shows the lag between sort of peaks and troughs in housing price appreciation on a year-over-year rate of change basis tend to be about 12 to 18 months ahead of the peaks and trough in year-over-year rate of change in owner's equivalent rent. So that's suggestive just based on these peaks. You know, we could be seeing an acceleration in shelter inflation, particularly through owner's equivalent rent, which is calculated on a much longer lag than observed home price changes for extended period or for over a year from now. And to me, I think that's a real big issue. If you think about a Fed that's, you know, kind of hoping and praying that inflation is still kind of transitory, you know, that's where this whole concept of a September pause came out of. And unfortunately, right, you know, Brainard has walked that back, you know, pretty forcefully. I think they're going to do a lot more walking back if these inflation statistics over the next couple of months don't do what I think the markets are really hoping that they do.
Yeah, Darius, obviously, while we're talking about monetary policy, we have a global view here on Real Vision Daily Briefing. I know that you have a global view at 42 Macro. Obviously, tomorrow, one of the topics of conversation, ECB rate decision expected. What's your take on what's happening in the euro area?
Yeah, so the situation in Europe is fascinating. Because on one hand, it's pretty clear that Europe's engaged in a cyclical slowdown. When you look at the furthest leading indicators, the ones that have the longest lead times, like the ZOO index or the Sentix index, you know, these things tend to lead the PMIs over in Europe. You know, these things are in recession mode. You're even seeing some of the lagging hard data already start to break down in Europe. And so it's pretty clear that Europe is having a much more sort of adverse response to the geopolitical consternation. The inflation dynamics in Europe have obviously been even more off the charts than they have been in America. I've showed a chart a few times in this program where we show the inflation surprise indices for US versus the Eurozone. And the Eurozone inflation surprise index is literally like several times higher than the US inflation surprise index. And you're obviously seeing European inflation accelerate to an all-time high in the most recent month in the May data. And so there's very clearly a bigger issue. The inflation is surprisingly a bigger issue in Europe than it is in America, which I think it's pretty hard for most American people to believe that, but it actually is true. And so that puts a lot of pressure on the ECB, and they've acknowledged it, and they're likely to do something to really giddy up in terms of tightening monetary policy, tightening financial conditions to, you know, the bare minimum, put a floor in the euro. So what's likely to happen tomorrow, they're likely to end their asset purchase program because they've guided to rate hikes starting next month, starting in July. And so they got to get that done. And in order to give them some policy space to do that, because they've sort of guided to not wanting to do both of those things at the same time. It doesn't make any sense, right? Why would you be doing QE and then rate hiking at the same time? I think it's preposterous that they're ending QE a month before they start hiking rates, but that's neither here nor there, right? The Europe, you know, they have a different mandate relative to the Fed in terms of keeping the whole European project together.
Yeah, a paradox in monetary policy? I don't believe it.
Yeah, no. Well, another paradox, this is, you know, again, nerdy macro strategist joke, but, you know, what do you call, like, how do you know you're in a globally synchronized downturn from a growth perspective? The ECB hikes interest rates, right? Like, you got to go back to the summer of 2008 during the global financial crisis. Jean-Claude Trichet, our buddy, hiked interest rates because, again, going back to those that time, inflation was a big issue back then. You had crude oil going up to $150 a barrel thereabouts on Brent. And then 2011, in the middle of their own sovereign debt crisis, they hiked interest rates because, again, the inflation dynamics really came home to roost. And so we think we're a very similar setup today. And one point I'd finally make is you have pretty much every major central bank, with the exception of the Bank of Japan and People's Bank of China, actively engaged in draining liquidity from financial markets. And obviously the Fed's going to be the 1,000-pound gorilla in that matrix. This is very unlikely to be this is going to be a bumpy ride. We've never really seen this kind of coordinated tightening before on a pro-cyclical basis. Usually monetary policy is being removed, liquidity is being removed when the economy is getting better. You go back to the last QT episode, you know, the vast majority of that QT occurred when the economy was accelerating to a 10-year high in growth. You look at it from a U.S. and global growth perspective. Right now, they're pro-cyclically accelerating tightening into the teeth of a slowdown. And in my opinion, I'm not sure asset markets have fully priced that in.
Yeah, boy, that's a really dark, cynical punchline about the ECB.
Yeah, well, look, they put it on the tape.
Yeah. Hey, Darius, let's talk, flip the script over here a little bit, 180 degrees. We're talking about this idea that the cure for high prices is more high prices. Is the cure for low prices more low prices? There's a story that I saw earlier today that Kathy Wood over at ARK has purchased 55,000 shares of Tesla. Obviously, this is Tesla off about 50%. From November all-time highs. What's happening there? Is Kathy ahead of the curve, or is she dangerously close to getting over her skis in a market that may continue to decline?
I mean, it depends on your duration, right? Like, you know, I'm sure Tesla 5 years from now will be one of the biggest stocks. It'll be worth a couple $1 trillion, if not more than that. And Kathy will have been right on that purchase if you give her the time horizon. If, however, you're someone who doesn't want to blow up your money in between now and, let's call it, year end, you know, when we are, based on our analysis, we think the Fed's likely to remove somewhere on the orders of $915 billion drain from excess liquidity between now and year end. Like, I'm not sure that buying Tesla is a good idea ahead of that. There's a view in financial markets right now, in terms of the debates I'm having with institutional investors, that a significant amount of the tightening has been priced in. But historically speaking, that has not been the case. It's very difficult to price in the mechanical dynamics of quantitative tightening, the mechanical dynamics of a dramatic increase in the reverse repo facility, you know, the mechanical dynamics of, you know, Janet Yellen issuing a bunch of coupons in a market that is effectively, you know, extremely short duration. Like, those things have to happen. And so it's our view that, you know, those kinds of, you know, this Kathy Wood, I'll use her as a poster child for this brazen attitude of risk takers that still right, very much exists. Right. You know, a lot of investors made a lot of money from the lows of 2020 to the highs of 2021 and whatever asset class they were long, or the highs of January 2022. If you think it from a U.S. equity perspective, and a lot of those people think that it was their brilliance. a lot of them don't realize that it was just the Fed balance sheet expansion, the expansion of net liquidity. And oh, by the way, this massive thing called a globally synchronized recovery off a lockdown depression in April of 2020. Well, basically all those factors are working in reverse. So it's unclear to me why investors haven't materially altered their asset allocation, which is something we can observe in the positioning data when you look at the flow of funds report.
Yeah, indeed. And you make precisely the right point there, which is the notion of the duration that you're looking across. Obviously, these are incredibly volatile stocks. Obviously, they are sensitive to interest rates. But Cathie Wood has been a visionary at discovering innovation, depending upon the holding period, a really critical point.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Talking about Tesla, talking about high duration stocks, something that it's correlated to, of course, digital assets, cryptocurrency. I wanted to show a clip from a conversation earlier today. Nico Brugge and Santiago Velez and I on a show called Crypto Unwrapped. This is a weekly show that we're doing here at Real Vision that we're streaming live every Wednesday, looking at what's happening in digital asset markets across the board. A conversation today that we had about some new legislation potentially coming down the pike from two senators, Kristen Gillibrand and Cynthia Lummis. Let's take a look at that clip right now.
Huge regulations released yesterday, proposals in the Senate by two senators, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York and Senator Lummis from Wyoming, longtime Bitcoin supporter. So that's a wide-ranging, comprehensive bill that seeks to, I guess, address multiple regulatory uncertainties in various categories. We could go through a deep dive into the bill. It's a massive statement from the Senate. So we'll see whether or not it's going to get passed. There's bipartisan support in it so far. It looks to follow right along the lines of the president's executive order that was released earlier this year to kind of get consensus in the various regulatory bodies on who's going to govern what and what the definitions are. So it's very encouraging. I'm looking forward to it.
So obviously, regulatory risk has presented itself as a significant headwind in the space. If we can get some resolution, some clarity in that space, probably a tailwind. Darius, thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, this is a sell the rumor, buy the news event, regulation in the digital asset space, in my opinion. You know, it's pretty clear to me that there's several things that are very clear to us in terms of our research. One, if you look at the output of our secular inflation model, it's pretty clear that the trend in inflation, at least in the US, is sort of transpose itself about 40% higher, which implies that you're going to have, you know, 40% lower real interest rates on balance, assuming no real material change in the policy regime. So that's one. That means there needs to be an asset allocation pivot from a strategic asset allocation perspective out of this concept of 60-40 and maybe into something that looks more like 60-30-10 or 60-25-15. And where that 10 and 15 is, if things like commodities, real assets, et cetera. And I do believe that there is an institutional sort of there's a dam of institutional capital waiting to be allocated to the digital asset space. You know, things like Bitcoin as a store of value, other tokens, et cetera. The problem with that dam is, one, we continue to see a tremendous amount of volatility that makes some investors hesitant. But I think the bigger problem, particularly from an institutional investment perspective, is you don't know the rules to the road. Is it a security? Is it not a security?
Right.
What's this? How is this going to get regulated? What happens in the event of default here, or this you know, it's Tether or whatever, these tokens, et cetera, go bust? Like, all that stuff needs to get regulated in order to understand the rules of the game and the path of the road. And I think if that is the case, you're going to see a tremendous amount of capital flow into the digital asset space, particularly in an era of really low negative real interest rates.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That makes perfect sense. And precisely the way that institutional investors think about the types of headwinds in terms of an absence of regulatory clarity, this is something that institutional investors who need to come in at scale are always very concerned about.
Totally. Absolutely.
By the way, I should say that clip you just saw is a slice of the in-depth analysis you'll get from Real Vision's newest show, Crypto Unwrapped. Just like Real Vision Daily Briefing, it's a deep dive into the major stories that are happening in the crypto space. We're running that live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7:30 p.m. in Mumbai, and 10 p.m. in Hong Kong. A global market, a global show. Darius, we've got a lot of questions flowing in right now. Want to jump into them?
Absolutely. Just hop into the kiddie pool. Let's do it.
Okay, first question, simple one. Ed Burke wants to know, what's the prediction for CPI on Friday?
No offense, Ed. I think you're asking the wrong question. It's about whenever you're walking into an economic release of consequence, it's less about what happens and more about what the market is set up to do into right. the event. And so there's a couple things that I call out. if you look at the market setup, the market structure. One, we're broadly, at least prior to today, we were broadly overbought on most indices, at least according to our probable range process. And then when you look at the sort of crowding analysis that we do to sort of identify extremes in derivatives markets to take advantage of, you know, the market setup continues to be quite negative with a pretty significant implied volatility discount, a pretty significant reduction and skew relative to the 1 year trend. And so this setup for the market is basically priced for perfection. So if this thing sneezes in the wrong direction on Friday, that's all that matters. And so, you know, try to reorient your mindset away from playing pin the tail on the donkey and reorient your focus budget really to understanding the setup heading into these events.
Yeah, I'm going to be sneezing on the wrong direction on Friday and probably all week because it's peak allergy season here.
Holy
in New York
cow,
City,
so. Pollen, huh?
I should apologize for sounding a little hoarse. I have terrible allergies at this time of year. So let's break in. This is a question from Jim Griffin, Real Vision website. Doesn't inflation break when goods deflate and not when services deflate? Darius, you touched on this a little bit earlier. For people who don't follow macro markets as closely as you do, give us a little bit of an explanation for what that means and why this distinction is so material.
Yeah, no, so he's right. And what he's identifying is the fact that services inflation dynamics tend to be stickier. You tend to get more variance in goods deflation. And by the function of that variance, it tends to be the dominant driver of the variance in CPI, but it's clearly not the dominant driver of the actual overall price level of the economy. And so my point is that clearly the variance in core goods inflation and goods inflation broadly, if you look at commodity prices, has been the dominant driver of why we have, you know, 8.3% headline CPI at the current juncture. The point I'm making is that if that variance is reduced at any point in time over the next few months, the probability that the variance, the change in services prices takes over as the dominant driver is actually quite high, and services prices continue to accelerate to the upside. And that is very counter to what I believe has become a very sort of, you know, I wouldn't say fully consensus, but pseudo consensus market narrative that inflation's peaked. It's going to be under control in a few months, and the Fed's going to pause, and you know we'll be back to something that looks like QE by the end of next year, by the beginning of next year. And to me, I think the only path to getting something that looks like QE or what we call Federal Reserve ambulance sirens at 42 macro is through the soup. You got to have the pain to get the gain. You're not going to have your cake and eat it too, unless of course, for the first time in recorded history, inflation just magically disinflates without a reduction in demand, without a reduction in profitability, et cetera.
Darius, fill in a little bit of the context. Why is that the case with goods inflation versus services inflation? Is it because you have to basically spin up physical productive capacity, factories coming on and offline, and there's some lag and lead times there?
Yeah, absolutely. So it goes back to the supply chain, right? So you have inventories, you have shipping, you have, you know, sourcing, production, all these different things are, you know, sort of, you know, lead to, you know, variable costs, variable time of delivery, variable orders. You know, the fact that it is a physical good means that more hands need to touch it, more things, you know, need to be shipped, it needs to be stored, and all those things have costs associated with them. Whereas services prices tend to sort of be set on a contractual basis. Not all services, obviously, you think about something like an airline ticket, but generally speaking, you know, it's a lot easier to sort of pass through services prices. And as a function of that, you tend to see sort of more sticky prices that tend to climb in a less volatile way. And this is why you tend to see, if you look at something like core PCE, it tends to be dominated by services prices. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that goods doesn't matter. Goods, you know, goods is the variable part of the economy. If you look at the inventory cycle, right? We've been building inventories for the past three quarters. If you look at it on average, you know, 82% of the headline GDP we've observed since the third quarter of last year has been inventory builds. And so this is something Target's talking about, Walmart's talking about, and having overordered inventories to a goods consumption cycle that has effectively fallen off a cliff. I mean, if you look at it on a three-month annualized basis, the real personal consumption expenditures on goods is 0.2%. It's ground to a halt. And this is exactly what Target is telling you when they constantly revise their earnings estimates lower.
Yeah, here's one from William H. from the Real Vision website. This is a critical question. What do you think, Darius, about Q2 earnings and particularly about Q3 guidance?
Yeah, so I mean, look, these companies have to they've got to take down numbers, and whether or not they do that in Q2 or Q3, I think is moot if you're taking the sort of medium term time horizon. You know, one thing that's very incongruent with declining expectations for GDP growth, obviously declining trends across most economic statistics, you know, whether you look at leading indicators, you know, whether you look at even some of the lagging indicators are very much starting to show some real sizable deceleration. Even like, you know, we're supposed to be in a services sector boom, right? But real consumption on services in the U.S. in the most recent print in April is only 1.8% on a three-month annualized basis. That is not a boom. That's a below-trend growth rate. So you're really starting to see some decline in the growth rates in the economy. And so to me, I think when you talk about the obvious spillover impact to corporate earnings, particularly from an all-time high in operating margins, you know, 40-year low in productivity, 40-year high in unit labor costs, to me, it's the last major shoe to drop in terms of consensus having to get with the program on, you know, the sort of the path forward this year. We're not going to get back to this, you know, panacea state of, you know, low interest rates and quantitative easing until we go through the soup that is a significant slowdown in growth, a significant reduction in corporate profitability estimates, and a likely potential earnings recession, which I think is a very reasonably high probability.
Yeah. Darius, a great conversation as always as we come to the end of this show. Final thoughts, key takeaways that you'd like to leave our viewers with?
Yeah, there's I have a couple charts before I wrap up. I'll be very quick on them. The first chart, Brian, is the first chart says bear markets are common. And I just want to, you know, make this point very clear. You know, don't freak out just because we're in a negative environment. I think, you know, there's a general angst around what to do next, what to do next. Everyone's time horizon has shrunk, with the exception of Cathie Wood, who's buying the dip in all her favorite names. And oh, by the way, I know I promised to be short, but just one quick riddle. What do you call a stock that's down 90%?
Don't know.
It's a stock that was down 80% and got cut in half. And so I just want to remind everybody the percentage change math associated with these bear markets, going back to the chart, Brian. You know, bear markets are common. You know, we've lived in an era, if you look at the bottom right of that chart where we're showing the S&P 500 drawdowns, we lived in an era where we haven't really had to suffer, you know, too many bear markets. The Fed's balance sheet was consistently expanding. We had very low interest rates for an extended period of time. We are no longer in that regime. We are now in a regime that resembles much of the past 100 years, which is more volatility in economic statistics, more volatility in inflation statistics, more tighter policy from a monetary policy standpoint, the less globalization, et cetera, et cetera. There's just more friction. There's just more headwinds to, you know, capital market appreciation. And so I just want to remind everyone, if you look at this 100 years of economic history and market history, these things are common. And one final point I'll leave you with is the next chart, which is 2000 to 2002, FOMO. When you're in a bear market, so by the way, this is a chart just studying all the bear market rallies throughout the 2000 to 2002 bear market. Market was down three consecutive years en route to getting cut in half. The S&P 500, I think the NASDAQ was down 80% peak to trough. You had, I want to say, roughly about 10 bear market rallies of consequence, of significance, several of them 14, 15, 20% from that local low, and en route to the market getting cut in half. So the point I want to make is, you know, there's going to be several times throughout this process of the dramatic reduction in liquidity we're walking into and this potentially significant slowdown in growth that we're likely to observe in the next, call it, 3 to 4 quarters. There's going to be plenty of times where you think the market's bottom and you want to chase the stocks higher. But just remind yourself, you know, don't get the FOMO, because the FOMO is really how you get hurt. It's not the initial drawdown. It's the drawdown from the FOMO, because that's when you go all in.
I love it. Critical points about the nature of bear markets and 100 years of history to back it up. Darius Dale, thank you so much for joining us on Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Appreciate you, Ash. Appreciate everyone. Thank you. Catch you next week.
And thanks again for watching Real Vision Daily Briefing. Andreas Steno Larsson will be back tomorrow with Tommy Thornton. Have a good afternoon, everyone.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.